Welcome to the M-Files. You are listening to Valerie Anella Mayers, Patty Wood Finkel, and John Woodward, bringing you the news and interviews from the museum world. On this edition of the M-Files, we will be discussing COVID and the museum. And later in the episode, we will be interviewing our friend and museum colleague, Lisa Hachadorian, the executive director at the Museum of Art, Fort Collins, in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Hey, this is John. Before we move into the museum wire, here are a couple of quick housekeeping items. If you haven't yet, please find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheMFilesPodcast. Let's keep the conversation going in the weeks between episodes. You can contact us through our Facebook page or via email at TheMFilesPodcast@gmail.com. Just a quick note, our next episode of The M-Files will be dropping on Friday, December 4th, and we'll be featuring an interview with Nathan Doerr from the Draper Natural History Museum at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. So let's turn it over to the Museum Wire.
Welcome to the Museum Wire. This week, we are looking further at the coronavirus affecting museums in the United States and internationally. Most of us have read an article about how one-third of U.S. museums may not survive the year, and all museums have had to make changes throughout the world and how they are providing education and services and collections for their visitors. I think that if the pandemic continues, we may see some museums close, but we may need to rethink how the institution is designed in terms of use. Let's talk about this. What would you do in your museum, John, if the pandemic continued for the foreseeable future?
I mean, when we start talking about, you know, obviously visitor numbers are the largest metric that a lot of stakeholders look at. It might not be the most profound, but it's the most commonly looked at data metric. So if we start seeing people and seeing that those numbers decline, fewer people coming into the building, there's less of a justification for my governing authority to say and justify the need for a museum of my type. So there's always the possibility that, you know, funding is pulled or funding is reduced because we're not serving the number of clientele that we have in the past.
I think that all museums are having to make adjustments that we had not planned to make during the pandemic. Many museums have had to close play areas, lock down touch drawers and spaces where children and adults alike could manipulate objects, things that are just too difficult to clean, sandboxes, dig boxes, costuming, hats to try on, different levels of dress up, that sort of play, even as much as paper, crayons, markers, that sort of thing that might be in a museum's creative corner that are not easily cleaned. So they've had to pull them out of the exhibit or out of the interactive area for a while. And that's affecting us all differently. However, it's also giving us all opportunities to try something new. The museums that are open are able to look at what they're able to do and able to clean and able to responsibly give to visitors to manipulate and kind of pare down a lot of that very, very, while it was interactive, sometimes it was also overwhelming experiences for their visitors. So trying to find a silver lining in all of this.
And I think online platforms, virtual programs are very important. And a lot of people have been able to access those. But if this continues, we must address the question of access. Is there universal access? Or is it just those who happen to have computer and internet service to be able to partake in those museum programs? How will we in the future, if this continues, serve the full strata of society, which is so important to our mission?
So that's a great, great example. As we follow some of the museums in Europe that are having to shut down for their second round of COVID shutdowns, they have really been ramping up their social media platforms. The Tower of London, the Natural History Museum in London, and the British Museum have all really worked hard on their social media platforms. However, if you don't have a phone or a computer or access to the internet because you're on lockdown, there's no way for them to reach you.
Well, the other half of that coin is the smaller institutions that don't have access to those kind of resources. You know, imagine you have a small museum with maybe 5 to 10 people. You know, once you start getting budget cuts, you're going to start losing staff members, the furlough to RIF. So they're not going to you're going to be down to maybe 2 or 3 people or one. So how are you going to be able to develop and maintain virtual programs and maintain access when you don't have a staff to do it? So, I mean, it's great for the larger museums to, you know, lead the charge, but it, like even in the good times, they had the resources, they had the expertise, whereas their smaller counterparts don't. And it's gotten even worse.
Now, I have to come to the defense of the smaller museums. Our museum has a staff of 3, and we have a fairly robust online presence that was not there before COVID that we've worked really hard to develop. We have went from a Facebook page where we posted 3 or 4 times a week to a Facebook page that posts 5 times a week, Instagram that posts 5 times a week, a YouTube channel. We're doing videos, and 95% of this is done with my iPhone. And there's no other technology involved other than what I can do with my iPhone and my educator is willing to do in front of my iPhone. So there are a lot of resources, I think, that a lot of museums, though, are having to tap into avenues that they had never actually considered before.
But a lot of it deals with education. And we have to look back at studies, like the one that was done at the Smithsonian, that looks at visitor experience. Now, some people are coming for the object experience. Mm-hmm. They want to see the actual rifle that was used by this person, or they want to see the Hope Diamond, or they're coming to the museum as a social experience. People go on dates to museums, or they're bringing their children as a day out. And right now we are all in situations where we're more often quarantined. So not being able to go to the museum is really affecting why people might go, because it education is important, but it's not the only reason that people go to a museum.
That's true.
You know, it's going to be interesting, you know, looking long-term once pandemic conditions have abated, you know, whether that's 6 months from now or longer, depending on the current trends in medical science and the availability of, say, vaccines. How is this pandemic going to change the social interaction patterns for visitors? Mm-hmm. Are they going to feel safe going back, like the movie Jaws, going back into the water? Or, you know, in this case, going back into a public space where they might not feel as safe as they did even a year ago? So those societal changes going to be reflected not only in our general visitation statistics, but also in participation in educational programs, cultural events, other things that are hosted by museums around the world, not just in the United States.
I think it's going to be an interesting study a year, 2 years, even 5 years out from the pandemic. And museums are going to learn a lot from this situation. And hopefully most of us will be able to grow and expand from the situation and still have our doors open.
No, agreed. I mean, our biggest issue at this point is for those, again, those smaller museums or those larger institutions that are particularly financially vulnerable. You know, going back to the question of access, what is going to happen, what will happen if those institutions close and those collections are they going to be locked up, or are they going to be deaccessioned to other institutions? We don't know. Thankfully, those questions haven't been brought to the forefront due to the pandemic, in any kind of visceral sense, but they're still out there. And as the conditions continue, it's going to get closer and closer to that time.
So our museum colleagues have dialogued about this issue at conferences regionally, nationally. We'd love to hear from you. What's your experience going to the museum in the age of COVID, or not going, as the case may be? If you're working at a museum, what is your museum study? We would love to hear from you.
That wraps up the Museum Wire for today. Let's head over to our interview with Lisa Hachadorian.
Welcome, Lisa, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
My first question is the question that I ask all of our guests. What is the strangest thing that has ever happened to you at a museum? Now, this could be the museum you work at currently, a museum that you used to be employed at, or a museum that you were a visitor at.
Well, funny you should ask. I'll talk about the current museum I'm at, the Museum of Art Fort Collins. It's actually built on top of a graveyard. And so we do have a resident ghost named George that was named by a former employee. And I personally have had some instances where, and this always happens in the evening time, not usually during daytime, where I'm setting up for events. And I swear to God, this has happened more than once. The PA system comes on and you hear just system and it's not on. And other staff members have had strange things happen to them at night. So that to me is pretty ongoing and pretty strange.
That is a great story.
So yeah. tell us more about the Museum of Art Fort Collins.
Well, the museum has been in existence since 1983. It was founded by an artist, Roz Spencer, who lived in Fort Collins at the time as a venue for contemporary art. And, you know, in the beginning years, we moved around town trying to find a venue, and we've been in our current location since 1990. And it just so happens that it is an 1911 beautiful, beautiful Italian Renaissance building that used to be the old post office in town. And since 1990, it was converted into the museum. And the Museum of Art, let's see, our mission is to spread the power of visual art. And we do exhibitions of basically 20th century and 21st century art, local, regional, and national artists. And we don't have a collection. So we're like the MCA Denver and like BMOCA in Boulder, where we just do a continuing series of rotating exhibitions. And so we're a non-collecting institution.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
So just a quick follow-up on that, as a non-collecting institution, what are some of the challenges that your institution faces compared to, say, like the Museum of Nebraska Art in Kearney? What are some of the differences?
Well, funny you should mention them, because we took a field trip to them a couple of years ago, because they are in a 1911 old post office building built by our same architect same year. And we were like, we want to go see what they've done with their space and their building. So it is a little different. In one sense, if you know, museums who are collecting institutions can rely and do exhibitions, obviously, from their collections of many, many different types. And us not having that resource, we can't do that. But we're also, we can be a little bit more nimble in the types of exhibitions that we bring in. So it's a mix between traveling exhibitions from all different institutions around the country versus exhibitions that I happen to curate myself. So we kind of go back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So before the interview, we were talking a little bit, and you'd mentioned that you'd been working in the museum field or the art field for around 20 years. How long have you been with the Museum of Art Fort Collins?
It's coming up on 6 years. I started in December of 2014. So it's gone by very quickly.
It can that. Can you tell us a little bit more about your role? I mean, you've touched on that a little bit, but a little bit more of what your daily tasks might be. You know, what's a day in the life, so to speak?
Sure. Well, obviously that's kind of gotten thrown out the window with COVID this year, but it's a small regional institution. We have a staff of 6 to 8, and it's a mix of full-time, part-time, and contract employees. So that means that I basically do a little bit of everything. So, there is no typical day, but the day ranges from doing work on fundraising events, and the museum has 2 fundraising events in a normal year that we would be working on. And obviously this year is abnormal in that sense, because all of our fundraising events were canceled except the ones that we could put online. So it's working on them, and they're kind of large overview community-oriented fundraising events.
But isn't one of your events masks?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Isn't it the perfect year for masks, Lisa?
And yeah, and it was a perfect year for masks, and we ended up making the plunge and turning that into an online event, and it did fantastically. And we kind of built our whole marketing campaign on masks that you wear versus the masks that we show. And it was a huge learning curve for us, but it ended up working out really well. So we were happy with that. So otherwise, I tend to work on fundraising events, grant writing, other donor calls, strategic planning, obviously whatever is going on with the exhibitions that are on site and figuring out future exhibitions, educational programming. So it just kind of runs between all of that every day.
So you really do a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Would you share more about the education initiative for the institution, even if COVID has limited these programs at this time?
Sure. Well, with COVID, we've made the jump to digital, as a lot of institutions have. And so before COVID, we had an education space, and we called it the Art Eduosity Creative Space. And that's a mix of art, education, and curiosity. And it was a space where we had, I don't know, 5 or 6 different areas where youth and families could come in and work on specific projects related to the exhibitions that were on site at the time. And then that all changes over as the exhibitions change over. And with that space being closed for obvious reasons, we kind of pivoted to doing some online art classes for kids, again, related to the exhibitions. And then doing some virtual tours of the exhibitions as well. And as far as adult programming, that ranges everything from, you know, obviously lectures and gallery talks and panel discussions and things like that. But we do have a couple programs that are consistent throughout what we do. One of them is what we call an artist-to-artist house concert. And this is what I love and something that I've tried to bring to the museum is kind of the cross-cultural discipline and in informing the art that's on display. So whether it's music or literature or poetry or dance, kind of bringing all the other disciplines into the programming that you see. So we've got these artist house concerts. And so we bring in, you know, a local regional musician to play music, and it ranges. It could be blues, Americana, jazz, folk, any kind of style that somehow fits with the exhibition. And then we bring an artist in, and then they have interviews and conversation between the musicians and the artists and have an audience there that night. So that's something that kind of threads through every exhibition that we do as far as programming.
So since you've gone digital or virtual, I suppose, are the children's programs easier? Are the adult programs easier? Or is it 50-50?
Well, there was a learning curve, obviously, with, you know, figuring out the digital aspect and how do we get it online? How do we get it on Facebook? And once we figured that out, it wasn't too bad. It really isn't. It is another platform for learning. So it's been easier than I thought. And it's something that I think will continue even when things return to normal.
Whenever that might arise.
Yeah.
You know, besides the museum, you know, my colleagues and I know that you've been involved with the arts and different advocacy efforts. Can you share a little bit about your experience with art advocacy and maybe how that has changed due to the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Well, the one kind of big experience I had was back in 2015 and 16 with trying to get this SCFD initiative on our ballot, which is the Larimer County Scientific and Cultural Facilities District, which is, we modeled it after the one down in Denver. So it was trying to get basically a sales tax on the ballot for arts and cultural organizations countywide. And it was the third time or so that initiative had been tried to get on the ballot. And at that time we were successful, we got it on the ballot, and then it was the 2016 election and everything kind of fell apart and the initiative didn't pass. It was like 65-35 against. So we were kind of crushed, and didn't end up regrouping for this election cycle, since it seemed like it would be the same kind of madness as the last time. So we're still trying to figure out whether we want it to be Fort Collins based or maybe county based. And so those discussions are happening long term. And it was a huge education for me, because I kind of put myself out there and was standing out on the street corner trying to get people to sign the petition and talk about the initiative and see, you know, how the arts were kind of embedded in their daily lives or not, as the case may be. So it was you got to see a huge cross section of the population and how they valued the arts or not.
So earlier you spoke about Facebook. Could you tell our listeners a little more information about the Museum of Art Fort Collins's social media platforms and where we can find you?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you can find the museum at moafc.org. That's our website. And we do, we are on Facebook and we are on Instagram as, I think it's Moa Fort Collins. You can find it that way. And so, we try and do as much promotion of community events and also promotion of the museum as we can, and artists and themes and topics and kind of also fun art stuff, not to make it, all Moa all the time.
You do have a great Facebook page. I follow you guys on Facebook, so.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I try and bring in as much humor as I can, too, art historically wise.
So. Well, before we get to our bonus round for the night, we have a stock question we ask everyone at the end of the interview, just like Patty asked the opening question. What is your advice to emerging museum professionals and or students that are considering a career in the museum or arts field?
Well, I mean, I know you think this too, but I think it's a fantastically creative field, and it can bring in a lot of different types of thinkers. So, it's one that's not necessarily always for art historians and curators. And to me, it can be very wide open, and I like that about it. So you can bring in people from wide ranges of backgrounds. And so I would say, don't be afraid to explore. I think sometimes we put ourselves in our own pigeonholes, depending on what we think our interests are at the time. And I know with artists that I love and even, mediums that I tend to like personally, that changes over time. So it kind of like leave yourself open to exploring different areas in the field, and not just museums. And I guess I'm a perfect case in point for that, because in 20 years, I've almost explored every part of the art field, whether it's corporate art or public art or academia or nonprofits and museums. And there's just such a wide range of what you can do if you value the arts and want to work with it. So I guess I would say, go back to just explore and don't pigeonhole yourself.
So for our bonus round tonight, I would like to ask about your favorite recipe this winter. I think of you as someone who cherishes their cookbook and all of the recipes that they've collected over the years. If I remember correctly, didn't you once say that if your house was on fire, you would grab the cookbook?
I'd grab my binders.
Yes, your binders of recipes.
Yeah, which now it's all been digitized, so there's no more binders anymore.
Oh, but, we have entered the 21st century.
That was a year-long project, me sitting there and like scanning or taking photographs of every recipe. I was like, okay, Lisa, that's really too much. But my favorite recipe for the winter is something that's so super easy and so good. I mean, you could probably make it just by hearing it. It's a Greek recipe. It's beef with 100 cloves of garlic. So basically you take your huge pot, throw in your cubed beef, 100 cloves of garlic, a bottle of wine, like 50 Kalamata olives, and put it in the oven for like an hour or hour and a half. And it comes out, all the wine gets dissolved and cooked down, and the beef gets really tender and the garlic breaks down. So it just turns into this amazingly tender, garlicky beef, wine, olive stew. And I love it. It's one of my favorites.
That sounds fantastic.
Yes.
You can tell where my other passion is.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. We really appreciate having this time with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Very welcome.
That wraps up this edition of the M-Files. We'd like to thank Lisa for joining us and sharing her insights and museum experiences. Before we sign off, remember to keep the conversation going until next time by following us on Facebook at the M-Files Podcast. Also, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. Your input is appreciated as we continue to grow and develop our podcasts. Thank you.